Lecture 18, The Maccabean Revolt, Part 2.
Hello and welcome back. This is our second lecture on the topic of the Maccabean Revolt. I commented last time that in the case of the Maccabean Revolt, which broke out in 167 BC, we have more detail concerning a rebellion in the Hellenistic world than we have for any other episode, any other similar episode, and so it's necessary to look in great detail to understand what we can learn from this. And I commented that in the past people have tended to view the Maccabean Revolt, as resulting from the conflict between Hellenistic culture and Jewish culture. And I argued that, in fact, the causes of the revolt are somewhat more complex than that. And I've tried to isolate three sets of factors that contribute significantly to the events of 168 and 167 BC. The first series of conditions was created by the declining fortunes of the Seleucid dynasty in the first half of the 2nd century BC. We've already seen that Antiochus III, though he was an enormously powerful monarch, he was famous in the ancient world for having marched all the way across to India and virtually replicating the march of Alexander, nevertheless had been defeated in the Battle of Magnesia in 189, and in the following year at Apamea had signed a peace treaty with the Romans in which he had essentially given up all territory in Asia Minor, allowing for the creation, really, of the independent Attalid kingdom. And this had seriously weakened his kingdom, particularly because his kingdom had now had to pay a massive indemnity at the rate of 1,000 talents per year for a decade. And we also saw that Antiochus IV had also suffered setbacks recently. He had campaigned in Egypt trying to take advantage of the arrival on the throne of a new young ruler, Ptolemy V. But here we'd seen that Antiochus IV was essentially challenged or bluffed, if you will, by a Roman magistrate, Caius Papilius Linus, who had drawn a line in the sand and said, "Give me your response before you cross that line." And the response had been total capitulation. Antiochus IV had withdrawn from Pelusium, from the Gaza Strip, with nothing to show for two seasons of campaigning. The other conditions that I also pointed out, and which we'll be exploring in more detail today, were the tensions within Judaism in Judea between the Hellenized Jews, who had really assimilated Greek practices, and the Orthodox, to whom this was absolutely an abomination. And then the other tension, which gets less attention from experts usually, and that is the conflict between the city and the country and the different approaches to Judaism that one finds in those two regions. Events came to a head in 167 BC. In that year, in December of 167 BC, agents of the Seleucid king Antiochus IV entered the Temple of Jerusalem. They piled unclean offerings on the altar. They forced Jews to eat sacrificial animals and to parade wearing ivy wreaths in honor of Dionysus. Copies of the Torah were burnt. The temple was rededicated to Zeus Olympius. And 10 days later, after a pagan altar had been erected in front of the temple, a pig was sacrificed. An act which has been described as an act of unspeakable desecration of the people of Judea. And this persecution that's triggered off by these events must be set against the collapse of Seleucid fortunes in the eastern Mediterranean, as we've seen. And now it's time to see these events from the point of view of Antiochus's Jewish subjects. How did they perceive these events? Well, it is important to keep in mind that throughout much of the 3rd century BC, the 200s, Judea had been under Ptolemaic rule. In other words, it had been the far northeastern edge of Egyptian territory. And the generosity of the Seleucids and Seleucid policy towards the Jews had been prompted by an awareness that Judea was a buffer state between Egypt to the south and southwest and Syria to the north. It was what some people would call a contested borderland. The arrival of the Romans in the eastern Mediterranean, the defeat of Antiochus III in 189, the prospect of an alliance between the Romans and Ptolemaic Egypt, all represented severe threats to the power of the Seleucids in the eastern Mediterranean. Because in 168 BC, Antiochus IV faced the prospect of a Roman-Egyptian alliance, even at the same time as a new independent kingdom, that of the Attalids in Asia Minor, had also come onto the scene as an ally of Rome. So it was possible that now, in the 160s, the kingdom located in Syria, controlled by the Seleucids, could face enemies prosecuting territorial claims to Judea, enemies that would control the entire seacoast from Byzantium all the way down today, the western coast of Turkey, the southern coast of Turkey, and then in the south, along the coast of Libya, Cyrenaica, Egypt, and the Gaza Strip. In other words, the Syrian kingdom was facing a coalition of enemies on its western front, north and south as well. It is under these circumstances that the luxury of an autonomous Judea could no longer be afforded. And so I would assert then that the shift in policy that we find between Antiochus III and Antiochus IV comes not from any change in religious or cultural conditions. It is not an attempt to impose Hellenism at all. It is in fact a pragmatic, cold-hearted political decision designed to bolster the Seleucid control of what we've called a contested border zone. It can no longer be independent and allied. It must now be under their direct control. Already following his campaign in 169, Antiochus had carried off some treasures from the temple. He'd shown that his policy of generosity could be withheld or reversed when more pressing needs, not vague cultural notions, but specific pressing needs, such as an empty war chest, arose. That's what dictated this policy. Now, while Antiochus was in the south, campaigning on the edges of Egypt in 168, he received the news that a rebellion had broken out in Judea. Probably this violence was actually the result of civil unrest between rival Jewish factions, and it was not really an uprising against Antiochus at all. But to Antiochus, who was out of his kingdom and was campaigning south of Judea, it must have seemed as if the Jews had turned on him when he was most vulnerable. Furious, he returned to Jerusalem, where his armies, so it is said, slaughtered 40,000 Jews. And the following year, a Seleucid general named Apollonius was dispatched with 22,000 men to occupy Jerusalem, and specifically the citadel known as the Acra, the high point. From the Jewish point of view, preserved in the Book of Maccabees, this campaign and occupation was designed to terrorize the population. According to the Jewish sources, these men came with orders to kill all the men and to enslave the women. This, in fact, did not eventuate, although, of course, some innocent people were killed. But if we strip away the preconceived notion of Greek and Jewish antipathy that always bedevils the discussion of these events, I think we can find a more plausible explanation. And it is this. Apollonius's army was being sent to establish a Seleucid garrison deep in Judean territory, that is to say, deep into the region to the southern side of Syria, and to secure this region against either a combined Egyptian-Roman attack or a rebellion of the local population against Antiochus on his vulnerable southern flank, or both. One could imagine easily a triumphant Ptolemaic campaign of an army marching across the Gaza Strip and up into what is now modern-day Israel and heading towards Syria and promising liberation to the Jews if they were to join in the attack on the Syrian kingdom of Antiochus. Such a thing had happened in the 3rd century, certainly, when much of this region had been under Ptolemaic control. So, according to this interpretation, I would suggest that it is territorial and geopolitical considerations that were vastly more important to Antiochus than the questions of Hellenism, Judaism, or any other ism. There are no cultural philosophies at stake here. It is simply a matter of securing territory. Well, that's fine and good, but what about the Jewish attitude towards the revolt? Well, again, here, resistance to the Greeks must be put into the context of contemporary Jewish anxieties over assimilation. Religious Jews, those who held close to the law, railed against the men they called apostates, the people who had given up their traditional Jewish affiliation and who had lapsed in their observances. And yet there were many Hellenized Jews in Jerusalem. It was Hellenized Jews in Jerusalem who sought to reach an understanding with the various pagans around them. They had approached Antiochus IV, and they had been authorized to introduce Greek social practices. Now, we have an account of this in one of the books of the Maccabees. Of course, this is told from the point of view of the Jewish sources, and so their attitude towards the Hellenization of the Jews is essentially of condemnation. But we can see that there were actually many Jews in Jerusalem who believed that Greek culture was the culture that they preferred for themselves. So we have a description here of Jason, the Hellenized high priest, who, he says, quickly established a gymnasium at the very foot of the Acropolis, where he introduced the noblest young men to wear a, where he induced the noblest young men to wear a Greek hat. So these men are going to a gymnasium, a Greek institution, where they will probably exercise naked, which is something of an affront to traditional Jewish sensibilities. They're wearing Greek clothes, such as this hat. The craze for Hellenism and foreign customs reached such a pitch through the outrageous wickedness of the ungodly pseudo-high priest Jason that the priests no longer cared about the service of the altar. Disdaining the temple and neglecting the sacrifices, they hastened at the signal of the discus throwing to take part in the unlawful exercises of the athletic field. They despised what their ancestors had regarded as honors, while they highly prized what the Greeks esteemed as glory. And so he goes on to talk about these various practices. If this had been anywhere other than Judea, it would simply have been described in neutral terms as the local population beginning to act more like Greeks because they had adopted this culture. Because our sources are Jewish and are from a very orthodox point of view, they see this, of course, as a rejection of Judaism, of traditional Judaism, and a betrayal of it, in fact. So much of the Hellenism going on in Jerusalem had not been imposed, but rather had been adopted willingly. It was these Hellenizing Jews, not Greek colonists, who had built the gymnasium in Jerusalem. And in some of our sources, we're told they had disguised their circumcision, a clear sign in the eyes of many that they had turned their back on traditional Judaism. These Hellenized Jews were blamed by many of the observant Jews for the ills which befell Judea on the grounds that they had deserted Judaism. They had turned their back on the law. And yet, the translation of the Torah into Greek, which took place, as we know, in Alexandria, suggests that there were some people who felt that Judaism and Hellenism were not absolutely irreconcilable. And we saw in an earlier lecture that Josephus also seemed to suggest that there were those both on the Greek side, such as Hecateus, and on the Jewish side, who felt that the two cultures really were comparable and could fit together. That assimilation did not mean a betrayal of Judaism, it was merely a different expression of it. Be that as it may, it was in this society of Hellenized Jews that the factional rivalries broke out, which would eventually be catastrophic. The key rivalries that we know of were among members of a powerful clan known as the Tobiads. Early in his reign, Antiochus IV was approached by one of the Hellenized Jews of Jerusalem, a man named Jason, who happened to be brother of the high priest. So clearly he was a man of great standing and influence. He came from this leading family. But Jason came to Antiochus with an extraordinary offer. He offered the king 360 talents of silver if in return Antiochus recognized his claim to the high priesthood. Well, We know that at this time the Seleucid kingdom was strapped for money, and we know that they were engaged in expensive campaigns. You can probably guess the result of this deal, this bargain. The money was paid to Antiochus, and in return, Onias was deposed, and Jason took his place as high priest in Jerusalem. Now, Jason, this Hellenized Jew, seems to have renamed the city of Jerusalem as Antioch. What he was trying to do was to recast the city now as a Seleucid city, just like the other Antiochs and Seleucias located further north in Syria. And of course, in the contractual arrangement of Hellenistic kingship, if Jason were to be the loyal vassal ruling in a city that was a Seleucid city like those of Syria, he would be left free to rule Jerusalem, quasi-autonomous, if you will, in charge of the Jews. But the story gets even murkier, because in a further round of intrigue, Menelaus, the brother of Jason, went to Antiochus and outbid his brother for the high priesthood. And Antiochus once again sold this position to the highest bidder, Menelaus, who took power, forcing Jason to flee. So we have no great clash of cultures here. We have rather a factional dispute within this one family of influential and powerful Hellenized Jews within Jerusalem. When in 168 BC a false report came back from Egypt that Antiochus had been killed, Jason crossed the River Jordan with 1,000 troops, chased Menelaus into the citadel of Jerusalem, and lay siege to the city unsuccessfully until he once again was forced to flee back across the Jordan River. Now, each of the disputes that we've talked about so far, and these are setting the stage for the full revolt that is to come, each of these disputes involved only the urbanized, Hellenized Jews who saw themselves as being both Jewish and part of the Greek world. Their advocacy of Hellenistic culture was part of the strategy for establishing their own power within the framework of the Hellenistic Near East. But in the countryside. In the countryside, away from Jerusalem, things looked very different indeed. Out there, Hellenism seemed much more alien, much more foreign. And the rebellion against Hellenism began, in fact, as a guerrilla opposition to the persecutions of Antiochus. It started in the countryside, where antipathy towards the Greeks and the Hellenizing Jews, was fueled by antipathy, the antipathy of the countryside for the city. Now, this is a traditional feature of early Jewish culture. Jewish tradition had distrusted the city as a place of power. The stories of Sodom and Gomorrah, for example, recall this. The story of the Tower of Babel recalls this. There are, in the Old Testament, stories that show how the culture of the early Jews maintained that there was something suspect and suspicious and corrupting about life in the city. For a culture whose ideology equated foreign culture with bondage, it is no surprise that the opposition to Antiochus should take root in the countryside and grow from there. Okay, the city people had given in, but not in the countryside. And we get a strong suggestion of this in the first book of Maccabees, because it's here that we get the account of the actual events when the revolt broke out. And I want you to notice the location of this. What happens is that as a result of Antiochus's attempt, helped, and Jason's attempts also, to impose Hellenistic culture now, what happens is that there is a reaction in the countryside. And First Maccabee says, the officers of the king in charge of enforcing the apostasy, the turning away from traditional Judaism, came to the city of Modin to organize the sacrifices. City is a rather glorified term there. It's really a village. Many of the people of Israel joined them, but Mattathias, the son of John, and his sons gathered in a group apart. Then the officers of the king addressed Mattathias. You're a leader, an honorable, great man in this city, in this village, supported by sons and kinsmen. Come now, be the first to obey the king's command, as all the Gentiles and the men of Judah and those who are left in Jerusalem have done. Then you and your sons shall be numbered among the king's friends, once again the vocabulary of Hellenistic kingship, and shall be enriched with silver and gold and many gifts. And here's the answer that he receives. Mattathias answered, "Although all the Gentiles in the king's realm obey him, so that each forsakes the religion of his fathers and consents to the king's orders, yet I and my sons and kinsmen will keep to the covenant of our fathers. God forbid that we should forsake the law and the commandments. We will not obey the words of the king, nor depart from our religion in the slightest degree." Out here in the countryside, these people are not having anything of this nonsense of Hellenizing the way that the Jews of Jerusalem have done. And as he finished saying these words, a certain Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice on the altar in Modin, according to the king's orders. And when Mattathias saw him, he was filled with zeal, his heart was moved, and his just fury was aroused. He sprang forward and killed him upon the altar. And that murder, that act of bloodshed, is the act that ignites the Maccabean rebellion, since it is the sons of Mattathias who are known as the Maccabees. So it begins in the countryside, as the country Jews resisting Hellenism, resisting the policies being implemented in the city of Jerusalem, stand up to oppose anything that reeks of Greek culture or Hellenism. Now, I wish to emphasize that because I want you to keep that in mind for when we get to the very end of this lecture and where we'll end with the Maccabees at the end of their history. It begins as these Orthodox Jews strongly resist any Hellenistic policy coming down from the king or from the Hellenized Jews of Jerusalem. The first campaigns of the resistance were glorious. Supported by his brothers Simon, Joseph, and Jonathan, the leader of the revolt, Judas Maccabeus, the son of Mattathias, defeated the army of Nicanor, a general dispatched by Antiochus, and succeeded in capturing a number of Seleucid fortresses. The Maccabean revolt, it continued even after the death of Antiochus IV in 163, and there was even a time when Antiochus attempted to resolve the revolt before his death diplomatically, with a letter invoking the age-old goodwill of the Seleucids and the Jews towards each other. But they had been set on their path of revolt, and the path of revolt led eventually to independence. The purification of the temple by Judas Maccabeus in 164 BC must surely have been one of the most extraordinary moments in Jewish history. It must have had an extraordinarily powerful effect on Jewish conceptions of the independence of their own country, the separateness of their culture, and the potential power that lay within themselves. From the late 160s onwards, nominally, Seleucid governors continued to be appointed to control Judea, but in effect, the country was already established as a kind of independent state on the outskirts of the Seleucid realm. Hostilities would be renewed in the reign of Antiochus V, and they would continue down for the next generation through the 150s and the 140s. Eventually, a series of compromises would be worked out, and it's actually in the compromises, not in the revolt, that I think we get the true story of the relationship between Hellenism and Judaism. So while most stories of the Maccabees stop with the purification of the temple, I would like to go a little further and take us into the generation after the Maccabees. In 159 BC, the leaders of the Maccabees, Jonathan and his brothers, were granted amnesty on condition that they leave Jerusalem alone. Perfect illustration. The city is one thing, the countryside is another. In 153 BC, faced with a pretender in his own realm, the Seleucid monarch, and the later Seleucids were very weak by comparison with the earlier kings, this Seleucid monarch, Demetrius I, Demetrius the Savior, was forced to make even more concessions and to withdraw the Seleucid garrisons from Judea altogether. So, in effect, because there's no Seleucid military presence, the country is really independent. The pretender to the Seleucid throne at this time, a man called Alexander Ballas, offered an even greater incentive to the Maccabees, and he offered Jonathan Maccabeus, the robes of the high priesthood. So we've reached a point where the very family which had led a revolt against those who bartered the high priesthood for their own profit and power was now complicit in exactly the same world of political maneuvering that they'd rejected. The revolt had begun with the Maccabees standing fast for Orthodox law against Hellenism. But now they're trading for the high priesthood as badly as Jason, Menelaus, and any of the others who had come before them. Jonathan continued in this position of high priest until 142 BC, by which time the last Seleucid garrison in Judea had been withdrawn, leaving the citadel of Jerusalem empty, and Judea by this stage now had been released from all tributary obligations. Let's take the story a little further, because it continues to get even more interesting in my opinion. Jonathan was succeeded by his son Simon. Is this beginning to sound dynastic, perhaps, with generations succeeding generations? And Simon, in 140 BC, was crowned in exactly the typical manner of a Hellenistic king. Soon his domain would display a bureaucracy full of Greek names, a professional army, a mercenary army, a calendar which took its date from the regnal years in year such and such of King X. A royal mausoleum put up in the village of Modin, where the entire revolt had begun. All right, so the dynasty has the place that it goes back to, from which it begins, and where all the kings are to be buried. And the unmistakable sign of Hellenistic kingship, coinage, with Greek inscriptions issued in the name of the dynasty, the Hasmonean kings of Judea. We've really come full circle. What began as a revolt against Hellenism, and which began particularly amongst those Jews who opposed not only the Hellenism of the Greeks, but particularly the Hellenism of the Jews who had assimilated, in the space of only a generation or two, even less than 30 years, has finally culminated, yes, in the independence of Judea, to be sure, but independence on what terms? It is now a Hellenistic kingdom that in every way imitates the very thing which it sought to reject in its origins. That, I think, is the true and underlying story of the relationship between the two cultures. Not a simple one of apostasy or rejection or cultural resistance, but rather an astonishing mosaic is what we find in Judea in the second century, a mosaic with all sorts of conflicting cultural positions, all sorts of conflicting beliefs, all sorts of different classes and tensions, with none of them properly reconciled. Although one strand of Judaism would continue, of course, to oppose any accommodation with non-Jewish practice, whether this be the Hasidim of Judas Maccabeus' day or the Pharisees of the first century BC, but there would also be another strand of Judaism that ran throughout the diaspora, but especially amongst the elite within Jerusalem, and I think also particularly in Alexandria, for whom Hellenism was not an alien wisdom. It's this multiplicity of meaning. It's in this multiplicity of meaning that I think we get the true relationship between the Greeks and the Jews. In fact, it's almost wrong to be using simplistic terms like the Greeks and the Jews as if they were two simple groups. In fact, both sides of the equation included a multiplicity of positions and opinions. And in that respect, the complexities of the Maccabean Revolt, I think, very provocatively foreshadow the complexities of the modern world, where the same debate really exists. To be Jewish, does one have to be Orthodox? Or are there other ways of expressing that particular identity? That's never really been reconciled in the modern world, and I don't think that it was ever reconciled in the world of the 3rd, 2nd, or 1st century BC either. But I think in the story, the paradoxical story of a revolt and a rebellion that ended up in establishing a Hellenistic kingdom, we have a suitable paradox to stand for the way that cultures spoke to each other in the Hellenistic world.